Now, this morning, as we get into the Word together, you guys have the blessing to get to hear from another one of our pastors on staff here. I recognized that as we were going through our annual meeting, we kept talking about the transition that we were going through as a church, and I failed to mention that we were also transitioning our young adult ministry. And as I said in the first service, it's probably good that I didn't remember because it was such a smooth transition for each of these two people. We have Dylan Murphy and his wife, Jacintha, who have been serving as our young adult pastors here at the church and serving in this ministry. And we are very excited about what they are doing in this ministry. But I'm even more excited that Dylan gets to come and share from God's word with us today. He is passionate about God's word, handles it well. And so I believe that you are in for a treat. Would you welcome Dylan, our young adult pastor, as he comes and shares from God's word?
Thanks, Ron. This is great. One of the worship leaders threatens to reorganize my notes, and they actually followed through. I'm just going to hang out here and get these all good. Great. It could be so weird. You just go backwards. Anyways, I'm just so glad to be here with you guys. Thank you for welcoming my wife, Jacintha, and I. We're glad to be here. We have our young adult constituency over there and then sort of throughout. So yeah, woo. I don't do that too loud. Anyways, we're glad to get to be here, even though we came from Colorado and we knew what we were getting into with the weather, so it's all right. We're in it with you guys. I'm excited to get to be part of this series talking about Joseph and how God formed him into the calling that God gave him. And if you haven't been here for the last couple weeks, or maybe if you just need a refresher, our story starts not with Joseph, but with his father, Jacob. So Jacob got renamed to be Israel by God because a nation was going to come from him. His grandfather Abraham had been promised by God that a great nation would come from him. And so God changed Jacob's name to Israel, and Israel had 12 sons. And Joseph is one of these 12 sons, and he is the favorite. And everybody knows because he has this coat that he wears around, and also because he has some dreams. So he has these dreams that he's actually going to rule over his brothers and his mother and his father. And it doesn't go over super well. In fact, his brothers, they throw him in a pit and then they say, this would be better. Let's actually sell him. And so Joseph, at the age of 17, gets sold to slave traders. And he's taken into the foreign land of Egypt. And there he's purchased by Potiphar, who is the captain of the guard. And in the house of Potiphar, Joseph actually succeeds. God blesses his work and enables him to do great things in the house, such to the point that Potiphar actually puts him in charge over everything. And it sounds that within a foreign land, things might actually be going okay for Joseph, except that Potiphar's wife is kind of interested in handsome Joseph, and she comes on to him, and he keeps pushing her off. And then one time Potiphar is away, and she asks Joseph to come sleep with her, and he runs away. And then she frames him. And so as we enter into our story today, it's actually after Joseph, having risen in the house of Potiphar, getting framed for a crime he didn't commit, and having to pay consequences that aren't his due. And so in verse 20 of chapter 39, it says, Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. But while Joseph was there in prison, the Lord was with him, and he showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. So our lives are out of our control. Despite what our thermostats and our cell phones and our day planners and our cruise control and our American culture would tell us, we truly do not have control over every aspect of our lives. And we feel that and we see that when things go wrong, when things don't go according to our plan in small ways and in large ways. And it's these areas of our lives that are outside of our control that we naturally know the least what to do with. Because if I have bills to pay and I've got money, I just pay them. If I have work to do and I'm able to do that work, I just do the work. If I'm having a hard time, but I just need some advice just to sort of get me back on track, then I'm thankful for you giving me advice, but if I'm really stuck, if I don't have the money to pay the bills, if I can't fix the broken relationship, if I'm not able to do the work, then where am I? What am I going to do when I can't control my life? Some of us, we reach in and we say, if I can't control this area, well, then I'm going to control the other areas. If things aren't going well at home and in my family, I'm going to buckle down at work. If things aren't going well in this relationship, I'm going to try to manage all of the factors that go into it so that things turn out still the best that they could. We reach in and we sort of grab for and grapple for control. Where some of you, maybe a bit more like me, when we lose control and we can't make things work out the way that we want, we sort of want to just get away from that discomfort and want to say, I just want to take a nap, I want to take a vacation, I just want to be done. And so whichever side you find yourself on with control, I don't know if our natural responses lead us in the right direction. I had a mentor and counselor in college who oftentimes, throughout meeting with people that he would counsel, he'd ask him this question that seems almost offensively simple when they would be talking about something and getting sort of stuck in a rut or saying, well, I'm going to keep doing this. He'd say, well, how's that working for you? And you're like, well, I'm here. I'm talking to you, so it's not really working. How do we naturally respond to the uncontrollability of life? What do we do when you can't do anything? When you're just stuck waiting? Does God have anything for us in those moments of darkness? Or is it up to us to control them or to get away from them? And so for our time today, I have two questions I want us to get to answer throughout this time. And the first is, what's God's plan in the darkness of the pit? When our lives are falling apart, where is God? Where is he in the midst of that? And what is he doing, whether or not we can see it? What is God's plan in the darkness of the pit? And the second is, what is our part in the waiting? When I'm stuck, when I can't change anything, what do I do? Is there anything for me? What is our part in the waiting? And rather than run away from these questions, I want to invite us in to the pit. Joseph is going to find himself in a dungeon. That's the same Hebrew word for a pit. And so, like his brothers had thrown him in one, now Potiphar has thrown him in another. Joseph's life has been full of pits. And I want us to get to step into that with him and ask, where is God in our darkness? And so chapter 40 starts off in verse 1, and it reads, sometime later, the cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt offended their master, the king of Egypt. Pharaoh was angry with his two officials, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker, and put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, in the same prison where Joseph was confined. The captain of the guard assigned them to Joseph, and he attended them. So this chapter begins with three words that I think we're tempted to just sort of speed right on by and get to the action. Sometime later. Is that weeks? Was it months? Perhaps most likely it may even have been years. Joseph is there waiting in the dark. And what's he thinking in this time? We don't have verses to tell us. I just sort of wonder how is Joseph thinking back about his dreams? You know, maybe he thinks to himself, gosh, if I hadn't even spoken about those dreams in the first place, I wouldn't be here. Maybe they were like delusions of grandeur and I just made them up and I brought this whole thing on myself. Or maybe God gave them to me and Yahweh, the God over my land, he wanted to do those things, but then when I was sold into slavery, well, because gods are kind of only over certain regions in the ancient world, well, maybe God can't do anything here. My situation has changed so much, so drastically from what God had planned that he can't and won't do anything about it. Or maybe God still wants that for the family of Jacob, but he's moved on to another brother. Joseph has no way to know these things. How is he going to wait? How is he going to see God? How is he going to see himself in the waiting? And so here Joseph is sometime later, and these two prisoners get brought in. Who are they? These are two officials. They're termed servants of Pharaoh, but really, if you look at this, they're the chief cupbearer and the chief baker. The cupbearer would have mixed the wines and made sure that they were just great tasting and would hand them directly to the Pharaoh. And so he had personal direct contact with the Pharaoh. And if you look back and you study sort of Egyptian culinary confectionery stuff, they had over 40 different types of cakes and things that they would bake. And so this baker was in charge of the art of food in Egypt. He would bring these baking goods to Pharaoh. So both of these people were in Pharaoh's court. And for Joseph, it was just another day. God had blessed him by putting him in charge of the dungeon, but he was still there. He was still in a foreign land, still in jail. And here are just two more people under his purview. But as we're reading along, we notice Joseph had been put in the jail where the king's prisoners are sent. And here are two prisoners of the king that were particularly close to Pharaoh. Has God up to something? Can't know. So you have to read on. The second half of verse 4, it says, after they had been in custody for some time, each of the two men, the cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt, had a dream the same night. And each dream had a meaning of its own. And so Joseph comes to them next morning, and he notices that they seem really troubled, and he's like, what's disturbing you? Why are you so sad? And they say to him, we both had dreams, but there's no one to interpret them. I mean, I've had weird dreams, but I don't know, they don't tend to be a big deal to me. Why were these two grown men so troubled by these dreams that they had? In the ancient world, dreams were often understood as veiled messages from the gods. And they were things that you were supposed to understand and maybe even do something about them. But here's the thing, the gods wouldn't tell you what they meant. They sent you the dream. Now you have to figure it out. And as a human being, like you don't understand. Like what could these symbols mean? What's going on? And so you would go to, if you had the opportunity, you would go to the wise men. You'd go to the people who could tell you what these dreams meant because they had studied symbols, because they'd studied all these sort of patterns and things. And yet here were the king's officials stuck in prison. They're troubled because they have a message from God. And unlike their time in Pharaoh's court, where they could have just called up a wise man, they have no one to interpret the dream. They're helpless, and they're alone, just like Joseph. Maybe. Joseph says to them, don't interpretations belong to God? Tell me your dreams. This is the first time we hear Joseph speaking in this story so far. It's also the first time that we hear of God in this chapter. Joseph says, tell me your dreams. And so to our questions as to how Joseph was waiting in this time, we can actually find a lot about Joseph and God just through his initial answer. First, Joseph believed that God was near to him. He believed that God actually had some ability here. God wasn't just back in Canaan, because he doesn't say, hey, that's, you have dreams, and gosh, if you could get back to Canaan, then God could help you, but you can't. No, he says, actually, tell me your dreams, because he's assuming that God is present there. Joseph believes that God is near to him, even in his darkness, even in his situation seeming abandoned. Second, he also believes that God has power. He says, don't interpretations belong to God? God actually doesn't just give dreams, he gives interpretations. And he doesn't just give them in Canaan, he gives them in Egypt. God can do things here and now. And this is interesting because if Joseph believes that God has power to interpret dreams, couldn't God have taken him out of prison during this long time of waiting? So Joseph believes God can do things, and he also believes that God will do things. He believes that God will enable him to interpret the dreams. Joseph expects that God could accomplish what we would call a miracle And yet that miracle is not him being taken out of the darkness. It's actually him following God in faithfulness in the middle of the darkness. And one more thing I noticed is this whole conversation between Joseph and the cupbearer and the baker started because he noticed that they were sad and dejected. I was having a conversation with a guy who just got out of 10 years in prison. And he told me that one of the things that you never do in prison is show weakness. You don't do it. Do not show weakness there. And I don't know the difference between modern prisons and ancient prisons. And yet, in darkness, in difficulty, hardness and bitterness are a tempting option. It's a way to keep our souls safe from the pain of sensitivity. We can continue to keep our emotions open. We can continue to be sensitive people. We can continue to notice others, or we can close ourselves off. We can sort of put that armor on. Instead of choosing bitterness against God, but also just against everything, Joseph hasn't just put his eyes down. He notices. He notices these prisoners, and he asks. So he rejects bitterness, and he chooses compassion. So in just this short statement, we learn so much about Joseph. And initially, I go, okay, well, what do we do with this? Is Joseph just one of these Bible superheroes? We're like, okay, I get it. Joseph is, he's super faithful. He's just great. He's just great. And we can't be like him. Like, here he is just succeeding, accomplishing, faithful. And that's how stuff worked in the Bible. That's just not how it works with me. The reason that we know that that isn't true is because you can go back just a couple chapters and you can see Joseph at the age of 17. Did he take his dreams straight to God? No, he took them straight to his brothers and to his fathers. And whether or not that was wrong, I don't think we see the same Joseph even already at 17 as we do in front of the cupbearer and the baker. And so how was Joseph in the darkness able to respond this way? When everything was going wrong in his life, how was he actually able to speak these faithful words of God and to notice these people in their situation? I think the first thing is that he received what God gave him. He received the pain and the darkness. That's something we ever talk about. That he actually didn't just close himself off to this dark situation, to this frustration, to his limitations. He didn't just close himself off, but he actually received them from God. I don't want to disrespect the pain that some of us are walking through right now. God does not cause evil, but can we receive what's going on in our lives from him, through his hand? Not from his hand, but through it. Joseph was able to receive that and to stay near to God. And that's the second thing, is that he stayed near to God. If you look throughout the Bible and you look at how the people of God respond to God, it's all over the place. But you look at those who respond faithfully in times of trial, you can go to the Psalms, you can go to Lamentations, and you can see the people of God expressing their pain and their angst and their frustration and even their doubt, and yet all within faith, bringing those things to God. He stayed near to God, and I believe he brought his whole self to God. And as we look at God's faithful throughout time, those who have done his work, who have continued walking with him in the darkness, even when they did not understand, they received from him, they stayed near to him, even if all that meant was expressing their pain to him. And so will you receive what God has given you in the darkness and follow God in your limitations? Will you stay near to God in the darkness, sharing your whole self with him? Things you're proud of, things that show up in your soul that you don't like. I have a friend who wasn't always a friend. He was a mentor first. His name is Steve. And I met him at Bowling Green State University. And he was in charge of the ministry that my wife and I were a part of there as students. And he had an amazing impression on my life. I mean, honestly, to that point, I would say that Steve had made the deepest imprint in me towards living the life of Jesus. He showed me what it was like to like expect God's kingdom breaking into all parts of our lives. He showed me what it was like to be a wounded healer. He showed me what it was like to pick up my cross and follow Jesus. And other people had showed me along the way as well. And yet Steve was such a significant influence in my life and the life of my wife. And as I became friends with Steve after the years, we're talking, and he's brought up talking about that time when he led the ministry. When he led the ministry that formed me so much. And he talks about it as one of the more difficult, painful times of his life. And yet there I am, right in the middle of this difficult, hard, whether or not it felt dark to him, time, having been affected by him, having been formed, experiencing the fruit of his faithfulness in the middle of that darkness. Now, did God using Steve suddenly cause him to feel satisfied and everything to go super well? No, not necessarily. And yet, in that place, he was faithful, and it made a difference in my life, hugely. Faithfulness in the darkness. And so Joseph says to them, what are your dreams? Tell me what your dreams are, because God can interpret them. And so it starts off, and the cupbearer offers a dream, and then Joseph gives him what seems to be a good interpretation, and the baker says, oh, that sounds great. I'll tell you my dream, and give me a good interpretation too. That sounds wonderful. And so Joseph hears both of their dreams, and he tells them what they're going to mean. So first to the cupbearer. The cupbearer has this dream where he's squeezing grapes into the cup of Pharaoh, and he hands it to Pharaoh, and Pharaoh takes a drink. And Joseph says, in 3 days, Pharaoh's going to lift up your head, and he's going to restore you. You're going to be back in your position. The baker says, here's my dream. And he had this basket of bread, and the birds came, and they ate the bread. And Joseph says to him, well, Pharaoh's also going to lift your head up, clean off your body, and in 3 days, you'll be executed. And exactly that happens. In 3 days, it was Pharaoh's birthday. And I imagine probably thinking like an ancient king, he wanted to show that he was merciful and powerful. And so he brings the cupbearer back up to his position, and the baker is impaled. And in verse 23, it says, the chief cupbearer, however, did not remember Joseph. He forgot him. What's this talking about? What did he forget? What did the cupbearer forget? Well, when Joseph was interpreting their dreams, he said this to the cupbearer in verse 14. He says, when all goes well with you, remember me and show me kindness. Mention me to Pharaoh and get me out of this prison. Because I was forcibly carried off from the land of the Hebrews, and even here I have done nothing to deserve being put in a dungeon. God used Joseph powerfully, and there was no change in his situation. Unlike God, the cupbearer forgot Joseph. My wife and I have a friend, acquaintance, you can call him a sort of friend, a professor at Denver Seminary who we know named Dr. Grotheis. And he wrote a book, it was a couple years ago, called Walking Through Twilight, A Wife's Illness, A Philosopher's Lament. And in the book, he talks about his wife's journey through primary progressive aphasia, which is an early onset form of dementia. And he processes in this book what it's like for them as a couple to be enduring his wife's mind's disintegration. He writes this book, and if you look on if you look at the reviews on Amazon on this book, if you look at the reviews, people talk about how powerful this book is. Talk about God using this book. And yet, his wife remained in her condition. God used him powerfully, and there was no change in his situation. And so, we can hear all this, and we could stop right here, and there would be so much for us, truly. But I want to continue on, and this is the reason, because oftentimes I think we view this chapter, Joseph's life in the pit, as kind of disconnected from the chapter that comes after it. Because in the next chapter, we're going to see things really change for Joseph, and it's going to just be absolutely amazing. And we can say, well, that time in the pit, that was weird and awkward and difficult and not what God had in mind. But now, this is great. Joseph is all set. And we can tend to view them in disconnection. But I want to suggest that Joseph's appearing before Pharaoh in chapter 41 is not a departure from his time in the pit. It is the fruit of it. How God formed Joseph in the darkness enabled him to walk a certain way in the dawn. And so in verse 1, it says, when 2 full years had passed, again, time, Joseph realizing that the cupbearer had forgotten him. When 2 full years had passed, Pharaoh had a dream. He was standing by the Nile, and he sees these 7 fat cows come out of the Nile, and they look really healthy, and things are great. But then these 7, like, creepily emaciated cows, like, come out of the Nile, and then they eat up these large, healthy cows. And he wakes up, and that's troubling. And then he goes back to sleep, and he sees 7 healthy grains. And then there's these 7 sort of wind-beaten grains that are all just sort of gross and thin. And somehow they, in a way, consume these first 7 grains. And Pharaoh wakes up, and verse 8 says, in the morning his mind was troubled. So he sent for all the magicians and wise men of Egypt, and Pharaoh told them his dreams, but no one could interpret them for him. See, this is similar to the situation for the cupbearer and the baker, but for Pharaoh, it's more intense. Pharaoh, according to Egyptian religion, was a sort of god. He actually should have been able to interpret these dreams, but he couldn't. And he had all the resources of Egypt available to interpret the dreams, but they couldn't interpret them either. And that's when the cupbearer remembers, hey, there was one, this Hebrew slave, who was able to interpret dreams. And Pharaoh says, bring him in. Verse 14 reads, with these super quick verbs right on top of each other, there's just like loads of action. It happens so instantly. In verse 14, it says, so Pharaoh sent for Joseph, and he was quickly brought from the dungeon. And when he had shaved and changed his clothes, he came before Pharaoh. So one morning, he's in the dark. It's just another day in the dungeon. He's been there for 2 more years. And then suddenly, he is placed before the most powerful man in Egypt. Just like that. And in verse 15, Pharaoh said to Joseph, I had a dream, and no one can interpret it. But I have heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. The spotlight turns to Joseph. In my undergraduate at Bowling Green State University, there was this giant kiln. I mean, if you look it up, I think it's the 2nd largest kiln still in the U.S. Normal kilns you can walk into, this kiln would have whole classes of art students just sitting and eating lunch in it when it wasn't turned on. I mean, it was just, it's giant. Because you know that what kilns do, right? And so I had friends that took these ceramic classes, and they would talk to me about kiln day, but it was interesting because they weren't just peaceful and relaxed and glad about it. Because on kiln day, one of 2 things could happen. One is that their pottery could become what it was made to be. It could harden, its glaze could turn the right color, and suddenly they would have a finished piece. The other thing that could happen is that it could explode into thousands of pieces and even break other pieces inside the kiln next to it. Because if the clay of that pot had been formed with imperfections, with air pockets in it, the heat could cause it to crack and actually explode. And so the thing with kilns is they prove the quality of unfinished pots. You don't get to keep working on a pot once it's in the kiln. The fire's turned on. You're going to see what that pot is made of. And so the same it is for us. We aren't made in life's decisive moments so much as we are revealed in them. Joseph standing before Pharaoh is not going to suddenly become something. He's not going to suddenly change a direction that he hasn't been going already. He's going to continue in the same direction. And what we see is not going to be a departure from how Joseph has been living. It's going to be the fruit of it. And so we have the question, what's going to happen to Joseph in the kiln. Maybe he's going to come in front of Pharaoh and he's just going to plead. And he's going to go, you have no idea what I've been through, and I hope you get your dream figured out, but I don't even belong being here. Can you just send me back to Canaan? Surely you have the power to do that. He could plead before Pharaoh. Or maybe he could pretend. Cupbearer just said he can interpret dreams. Sure, he could make something up. He seems like a smart guy. So he could just sort of, here, this is what your dream means. Or maybe he could position himself and say, my God allows me to be able to interpret dreams. And so I'm going to interpret this dream, and really maybe you should keep me around in case there's other dreams that disturb you. Is Joseph going to plead, pretend? Is he going to position? What's he going to do with the potential control that is in front of him? And this is his response in verse 16. He says, I cannot do it. That's a great job interview answer. Jacinta and I show up, and they're like, okay, so we've got this plan for the young adult ministry, and we think it's going to be great, and we want to know if you guys are the people to do it. And so here's what it looks like, and can you do it? And I was like, nah. Sorry. God can. I can't. Wouldn't go too well. They might say, we love your theology. We need someone who can do it. You only say this out of radical humility and dependence on God. Joseph's reply is almost curt to the ruler of his known world. I can't do it. But God will give Pharaoh the answer he desires. And Joseph goes on to interpret the dream. And he says, hey, this is what's going to happen. There are these seven fat cows, there's these seven healthy grains, and that's going to be 7 years where there's going to be all sorts of food coming in. It's just going to be abundance. But then afterwards, the seven emaciated cows and gross-looking grain, that actually means there's going to be this horrible famine that's going to last for 7 years. And so he gives God credit, and he gives Pharaoh the spiritual gift of his interpretation of the dream that comes from God. But he also continues on. In verse 33, he actually begins to give Pharaoh advice. He says, now let Pharaoh look for a discerning and wise man and put him in charge of the land of Egypt. And he goes on to outline, hey, Pharaoh, if you get somebody who's capable, they could gather up all this grain and they could actually put Egypt in a great position to survive this famine. God's told you this not just so that you could know something interesting, but so that you could do something about it. And here's what I think you should do. Joseph has broken all the rules of negotiation. He has not kept anything in his back pocket. He has given his spiritual ability. He's given his natural ability. He's given the wisdom that he has. It's like a financial advisor before you even meet with him saying, well, here's kind of like a 50-page document describing your situation and everything you should do. And maybe you can pay me, but here it is. Completely dependent on Pharaoh, maybe on God. And so Joseph says all this. And we see how years of waiting in the darkness have formed Joseph internally. We see it in his humility, but we're also going to see it as Pharaoh notices. In 37, it reads, the plan seemed good to Pharaoh and to all his officials. So Pharaoh asked them, can we find anyone like this man, one in whom is the Spirit of God? And he may not have been referring to Yahweh. He just may be saying the Spirit of God, one who has this closeness to the divine. And in verse 39, it says, then Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has made all this known to you, and there is no one so discerning and as wise as you, you shall be in charge of my palace. And all my people are to submit to your orders. Only with respect to the throne will I be greater than you. And so suddenly, Joseph rockets from the dungeon into the light. And if we zoom back, we notice that Joseph is a different person than he was before. That unlike the 17-year-old favorite, Joseph is now the sort of person you'd want as a ruler. You wouldn't want 17-year-old Joseph ruling even his family. I mean, whether or not he sinned, he wasn't humble, he wasn't wise. But here, Pharaoh notices, you are wise, and you have the Spirit of God in you. Joseph is given elevation, he's given power, he's given great responsibility, and his ability to carry these things will come from how he walked when he had nothing in his hands. His calling, which is beginning to take shape, required his formation. And so I want to say to us today that our work of waiting today prepares us for our producing work tomorrow. How we wait with God in our pain here and now will directly affect what is going on tomorrow, but also our relationship with God today. We see God bringing to fruition his calling, and it's been through the darkness. And so if you read ahead, you get to see all of the stuff that Joseph does. He goes on this campaign, and he ends up gathering all this grain, and it ends up working. There's all sorts of crops, so much so that he even loses track in counting. And then there's these years of famine. And if you look in verse 55, it says, when all Egypt began to feel the famine, the people cried to Pharaoh for food. And then Pharaoh told all the Egyptians, go to Joseph and do what he tells you. If you jump ahead to verse 57, it says, and all the world came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph. As the chapter closes, the picture is Joseph as the ruler of the world. Pharaoh has faded into the background. Joseph is calling the shots. I was reading a book by this writer, Russell Moore. He does stuff with the Southern Baptists. He's the dean of their theology school. And he was talking about having kids. He talked about how originally his plan was to go and get the degrees and get all the preparation and not have kids yet so that he'd be able to, you know, move forward in the world. And then it would be time to have kids. That was sort of how his American dream lined up. And then he and his wife stepped into a period of infertility. He didn't have the kids. He felt like he was entitled to. He had to lay down his vision of becoming a father. And by God's grace in his story, they eventually did have kids. For some of us, that may or may not be the story with infertility. But as his kids came, he was able to say, Lord, I see you using that brokenness. I see you having used that darkness. Because these kids that I felt entitled to as part of my perfect life, I now receive open-handedly as your gift. Could he have received them if he had had them immediately? Oh, absolutely. And yet, there was something that God was doing in his heart, redeeming this brokenness. God did not wrong Joseph. God did not sell him into slavery. God did not frame him for a crime. There are things that have happened to you that should not have happened, that are evil, that are against God's will, and yet God can use them. God even desires to use them, not because he calls them good, but because he loves you, because he has called you to be his image bearer. In the same way, Jesus, as he was in the Garden of Gethsemane, pleaded with God, God, would this cup pass? Would this darkness pass? And yet, as Jesus held on to his Father in the darkness, as he waited in faithfulness, it brought the fruit of our new life. We're brought into that same story. We also have crosses to bear. And as we bear them, we produce the life that God has made us to give. Because Joseph held on to God, he was ready to walk in the dawn as the darkness passed. And one day, even our deepest pains today will pass. If you have faith in the Lord and you call him your Savior, he will redeem things. And yet, where are we today? In the darkness. How do we hold on to him in hope in our pain? I want to just offer a few things. The first is be honest with God about your darkness. If you read Lamentations, this book where the Israelites just pour out their pain over their exile. Read Psalms of Lament. Notice that faith is not withholding the pained parts of you from God. Be honest with yourself about your darkness. Bring it to God. Lament. Ask him to be there. Shepherd your heart in faith. Yet being honest. Second is, look for how God may use you in the midst of your darkness. He may not wait until the light to produce a miracle. He may not wait until the light to use you to bear fruit like my friend Steve did in my life. Look for how God would still use you in your limitations. And lastly, remember others in their dungeons. You may be hearing this whole sermon in a sunshiny place of your life. If so, wonderful. That's so good. Bring that to other people. Encourage them with it. But also don't beat them over the head with it. They may need you to sit with them in their darkness. Notice others in their dungeons. And so as a church, as we're moving towards doing more together, as we're becoming a church of life groups, not just with life groups, engage these things there as well. Be real about your darkness with those people who have received you, who are your brothers and sisters in Christ. And notice their dungeons. Notice their difficulties. See how God would use you even though you're in the pit. Notice that. Be with him together. I want to invite up the worship team, and you may have noticed that we did fewer songs of worship earlier in the service, and that's because we wanted to make space. We wanted to make a space that we don't oftentimes create in our culture, that we don't often create in our success, a space to get to be honest with God about our darkness, our disappointments, our limitations, the things that we can't control. So we're going to sing some songs, and we're not only going to sing them, there's an invitation here to also be silent, to go with the Spirit as he leads you, either to express faith in the pain, express faith in the dawn, or just to be with God and to walk with him in the pain, to open that part of you up to him. Maybe you don't sing a word, but you bring your heart to him. May you do that with God in this time. The first song we're going to sing has this line that says, I lean not on my own understanding. My life is in the hands of the Maker of heaven. May that be your prayer.